Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine, February 4th, 2024. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll read the featured story in the talk section of the magazine. A leading memory researcher explains how to make precious moments last, and as usual, interviewed by David Marchese. Our memories form the bedrock of who we are. Those recollections, in turn, are built on one very simple assumption. This happened. But things are not quite so simple. We update our memories through the act of remembering, says Sharlan Ranganath, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of California, Davis, and the author of the illuminating new book, Why We Remember. So it creates all these weird biases and infiltrates our decision-making. It affects our sense of who we are, he says. Rather than being photo-accurate repositories of past experience, Ranganath argues, our memories function more like active interpreters, working to help us navigate the present and future. The implication is that who we are and the memories we draw on to determine that are far less fixed than you might think. Our identities, Ranganath says, are built on shifting sand. David asks, what is the most common misconception about memory? People believe that memory should be effortless, but their expectations for how much they should remember are totally out of whack with how much they're capable of remembering. Another misconception is that memory is supposed to be an archive of the past. We expect that we should be able to replay the past like a movie in our heads. The problem with that assumption is that we don't replay the past as it happened. We do it through a lens of interpretation and imagination. How much are we capable of remembering from both an episodic and a semantic standpoint? It's exceptionally hard to answer the question of how much we can remember. What I'll say is that we can remember an extraordinary amount of detail that would make you feel at times as if you had a photographic memory. We're capable of these extraordinary feats. I would argue that we're all everyday memory experts because we have this exceptional semantic memory, which is the scaffold for episodic memory. I know it sounds squirmy to say, well, I can't answer the question of how much we remember, but I want readers to walk away thinking memory is all made up. I don't want them to walk away with that idea. But if memories are malleable, what are the implications for how we understand our, in quotes, true selves? At the risk of being pretentious, I'll get philosophical for a second. David says, you're not being pretentious. Okay, good. Because I always have this critical peer reviewer in the back of my head saying, don't say that. But your question gets to a major purpose of memory, which is to give us an illusion of stability in a world that is always changing. Because if we look for memories, we'll reshape them into our beliefs of what's happening right now. We'll be biased in terms of how we sample the past. We have these illusions of stability, but we're always changing. And depending on what memories we draw upon, those life narratives can change. Tell me more about what you mean when you say illusion. I probably overstated it with the word illusion, but there is an illusionary component. I think we have this illusion that much of the world is cause and effect. But the reason, in my opinion, that we have that illusion is that our brain is constantly trying to find the patterns. One thing that makes the human brain so sophisticated is that we have a longer timeline in which we can integrate information than many other species. That gives us the ability to say, hey, I'm walking up and giving money to the cashier at the cafe. The barista is going to hand me a cup of coffee in about a minute or two. This is everyday fortune telling that we do. There's nothing that says that the barista won't throw this coffee at me. There is this illusion that we know exactly what's going to happen, but the fact is we don't. Memory can overdo it. Somebody lied to us once, so they are a liar. Somebody shoplifted once. They are a thief. If people have a vivid memory of something that sticks out, that will overshadow all their knowledge about the way things work. So there's kind of an illusion there. David, if what we're remembering or the emotional tenor of what we're remembering is dictated by how we're thinking in a present moment, what can we really say about the truth of a memory? I think of memory more like a painting than a photograph. There's often photorealistic aspects of a painting, but there's also interpretation. As a painter evolves, they can revisit the same subject over and over and paint differently based on who they are now. We're capable of remembering things in extraordinary detail, but we infuse meaning into what we remember. We're designed to extract meaning from the past, and that meaning should have truth in it. But it also has knowledge and imagination and sometimes wisdom. David, I think everyone has seemingly inexplicable memories that stick with us. One for me is a lifetime ago, sitting in an internship and locking eyes with a person across the room whom I never spoke to. This two-second interaction is still kicking around in my head 20 years later. What could explain that? Neuroscience is terrible for picking out any one thing and saying why it happened. But if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, memory often is educated guesses by the brain about what's important. So what's important? Things that are scary, things that get your desire going, things that are surprising. Maybe you were attracted to this person and your eyes dilated and your pulse went up. Maybe you were working on something in this high state of excitement and your dopamine was up. Maybe she had a t-shirt on and it was like, oh, I know about that. It could be any of those things, but they're all important in some way, because if you're a brain, you want to take what's surprising, you want to take what's motivationally important for survival, what's new. And David, on the more intentional side, there are things that we might be able to do in the moment to make events last in our memories. In some sense, it's about being mindful. If we want to form a new memory, focus on aspects of the experience you want to take with you. If you're with your kid, you're at a park, focus on the parts of it that are great, not the parts that are kind of annoying. Then you want to focus on the sights, the sounds, the smells, because those will give you rich detail later on when you remember it. Another part of it, too, is that we kill ourselves by inducing distractions in our world. We have alerts on our phones. We check email habitually. So you don't remember being there because, to some extent, you were never really there in the first place. If you set time with your child, don't check email and turn off your alerts. That's the idea. Technology can be helpful for memory, but usually not in the way we use it. You're not really there if you're mindlessly taking pictures because it takes over the experience. When we go on trips, I take candid shots. These are the things that bring you back to moments. If you capture the feelings and the sights and the sounds that bring you to the moment as opposed to the facts of what happened, that's a huge part of getting the best of memory. David, I'm thinking of concerts where you see people watch the whole show through their phones. You're saying that the emotional connection to the event later on will be dimmer for them than if they'd mostly kept their phones in their pockets, even at the expense of a more complete record. There's conflicting data on taking pictures. Most of the data suggests that it's bad for memory. But there's one study that I found that could be good for memory if you're focused on the details that would put you back into that moment. For instance, I saw The Descendants. They came out for the encore, and Bill Stevenson comes out in front of the stage. He's like, I want to take a look at this audience. I've been playing for 40 years, and I'm finally at a point where I get to appreciate the audience. I took a picture of that, and that was one of the highlights of the show for me, seeing these guys who were a soundtrack from my adolescence be human beings in the moment. David, I almost find myself going back to music that I associate with melancholy memories. Yeah, I mean, you've got a legion of Smith fans all over the world who do that. David says, but what is the neuroscientific or psychologist explanation for why we would be drawn to re-experiencing melancholy memories? That's a great question. The science part of it is that we know for a fact that people tend to reminisce more about certain periods of their lives. They call it the reminiscent bump. These are the more formative years for our sense of self in some ways. We're becoming independent from our parents, and we're developing our careers and building relationships and so forth. When you reminisce about those periods, you go back to the highs and lows, the beginnings and ends. Typically, those are the things that you remember the most in your life. It depends on what you need in the moment. Sometimes we get solace from going back to these melancholy times and saying, hey, I feel better now, or I've grown from that experience. We still need to process that stuff, and we go back. Music has this weird ability to trigger emotional response. David, can you still picture the first concert you went to? I think I can. I remember that Joe Elliott's voice was just nowhere near as good as it was on Pyromania. Rick Savage was still pretty handsome in person. Can't help but notice that. Steve Clark was super cool with his scarf and everything. He looked rock and roll. That's what I can remember. In the book, you say this concert is a central memory. It was. When do you think it happened? Must have been 1985. Def Leppard was not on tour in 1985. Oh, brutal. Does that matter for the memory? That was a silly example, but this goes back to the question of whether the factual truth of a memory matters to how we interpret it. I think it matters to have some truth, but then again, many of the truths we cling to depend on our own perspective. There's a great experiment on this. These researchers had people read this story about a house. One group of subjects is told, I want you to read this story from the perspective of a prospective, from the perspective of a prospective home buyer. When they remember it, they remember all the features of the house that are described in the thing. Another group is told, I want you to remember this from the perspective of a burglar. Those people tend to remember the valuables in the house and things that you would want to take. But what was interesting was then they switched the groups around. All of a sudden, people could pull up a number of details that they didn't pull up before. It was always there, but they just didn't approach it from that mindset. So we do have a lot of information that we can get if we change our perspective. And this ability to change our perspective is exceptionally important for being accurate. It's exceptionally important for being able to grow and modify our beliefs. But it's exceptionally hard. David, people get stuck in memories, whether they're traumatic or more benignly negative. What are ways people can get unstuck? It's very hard. You know, the training environment I was in was very down on psychoanalysis, but it always comes back to memory. A lot of that benefit is from the sharing of memories. Maybe it's a sad memory, but I'm telling you, with the goal of helping me get over it, that in and of itself changes my perspective. We know that people tailor their messages for the listener. Then you reflect it back to me and reorganize it as an outsider. Once we go back and forth, we're updating the memory to something that's no longer my own. It's now shared. When you tell someone you shouldn't be ashamed, it changes that whole relationship with the past. The first person I ever did therapy with, he had a driving phobia. He worked through the behavior therapy part, which is just drive, until you habituate that biological fear response. But he didn't feel better. Eventually, he told me that he had a memory. How much of this was true, how much of it wasn't, I didn't know. But it didn't matter. He was gay. And he came out of the closet with his dad and got into an argument with him and then was in the car afterward and got in a car accident. Pretty clear, David says. Yeah, exactly. It was about processing that memory and what it meant to him. He hadn't told this to anyone. I don't know that he'd even thought about it that much. That was deep for me. David, do you think there's some core unchanging self, something that makes us us, Or is it all just this flowing assemblage of interpretations of memories that make the present make sense? Is that sense of self static? I would say that some parts of it are. Memory gives us the power to shift our sense of who we are. If you believe you're a failure, a lot of the power of thinking positive is remembering those times when you weren't and being able to supplement those beliefs. There's a dynamic sense of the self. I grew up in an immigrant family under challenges or circumstances, and that part of myself is locked away from most anyone I interact with. We have these little compartments that are rooted somewhat in memory that we can access at different moments. You say in the book that you dealt with racism growing up. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah. It was a different time, and there were very few people who weren't white in my neighborhood. At the same time, my parents were also concerned about fitting in. There was a sense of, at home, we have this Indian identity, but when we go out to other people's houses, you can eat meat and do what you need to do to fit in. On both sides, I'm being told you're different. I haven't talked about this. When I was a kid, my parents said I had attention deficit disorder. I was impulsive. All my teachers hated me. They said I should have skipped a grade, but socially, I wasn't there. So I was different in that way, too. All this stuff gave me this weird sense of self. I didn't understand normal behavior well enough to be normal, but I desperately wanted to fit in. That's where psychology really got to me, especially once I started to see that nobody really gets the truth. Everybody has weird flaws in their judgment. And David, but what do you do with these negative, formative memories? I put things in little compartments. Inside, I'm this nerd who's picked last. When I'm feeling bad, those memories are there, and that's who I feel like. It's a constant putting on the right hat at the right moment. Sometimes it feels like masking, but who I am now is the only reality. All that past stuff is grist for the mill, but it's not reality. That is the part that I struggle with. That's the part that when I was doing therapy, I tried to remind other people of. A lot of it is just reminding yourself, this is who I am now, because it's not like my being a nerd and being hated back then is more real than getting to do an interview now with somebody who interviewed Iggy Pop. This is reality, and nothing else matters. Now I'll read from the Screenland section of the magazine. The world needs love. Hallmark is cashing in. When more people are watching the Hallmark Channel than CNN, you know we've reached a new level of interpersonal isolation. This is a story by Danielle Smith. In this lull between perhaps the most successful slate of the Hallmark Channel's countdown to Christmas films ever and the Jane Austen-drenched debut of Hallmark's Loveuary 2024, it's time to admit that Hallmark movies are actually just Hollywood movies, and specifically rom-coms. Straight couples dance in well-lit venues to the music of real instruments. Wrenching decisions are suffered through. Misunderstandings abound. Soulful kisses are for denouements. Happy endings feel required by law. Call it vapid if you will, but the culture of the Hallmark universe has been around since the 16th century, when a shrew apparently needed to be tamed. Since 2015, when Hallmark started its own production arm, the network has been filling a slot that used to hold date night and slumber party films like The Bridges of Madison County, 1995, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, 1998, Bend It Like Beckham, 2002, and The Notebook, 2004. The people who love those films, like readers of romance fiction, which has led the print growth category, want quantities of quality storytelling, and Hallmark, whose company values include creating, quote, a more emotionally connected world, understands the assignment. The network's holiday programming, along with its films in general, continues its pine-scented journey toward cultural domination. Hallmark rose from the sixth most watched cable network at the top of October to the third most watched the week of November 20th, when it won out over CNN and MSNBC in total eyeballs. Decisions about who gets to be quaint can seem mawkish and basic, but they have far-reaching impacts. In 2019, Bill Abbott, the president and chief executive of Hallmark's parent company at the time, said, "Until we get to Walking Dead numbers, I'm not going to be happy." Almost 300 Hallmark Christmas films have been aired since 2002, including The Christmas Card, 2006, for which Ed Asner received an Emmy nomination. One of Hallmark's strategies, elevating television actors who are either aging gracefully or were tapped out at co-star level, is especially potent. As an example, 23 years after the Salinger siblings, Bailey, Scott Wolf, and Claudia, Lacey Chabert, were accepted to college in the series finale of the acclaimed teenage drama Party of Five, Hallmark's A Merry Scottish Christmas, starring Wolf and Chabert, made its debut. Portraying a different, estranged sister and brother who not only repair their relationship, but also discover they are Scottish royalty, the duo fall into the camaraderie of their Golden Globe-winning days. Hallmark, like various systems of artificial intelligence, is learning and easing up on its compositional jargon. In A Merry Scottish Christmas, Chabert's character has a love interest, and in Hallmarkian and Sirkian tradition, he is hunky, sensitive, and handy. Yet, unlike so many Hallmark heroines, she's not leaving a high-powered career in the big city for an ostensibly more substantial small-town life. Chabert's character thinks she can stay in Scotland if she can run her own medical practice. And the Party of Five reunion overperformed. Taking into consideration all ad-supported cable, A Merry Scottish Christmas was the most watched movie of 2023. The core viewers included women in key advertiser-prized categories, and the demographic details go broader than what many perceive to be Hallmark's viewership, crotchety and cane-shaking NCIS fans. What has become a cultural juggernaut began as a plan to market postcards. Joyce Raleigh and William Hall were born into Nebraska poverty in the late 19th century, and by 1911, they owned and operated a tiny venture called the Hall Bookstore. There they sold, among other printed goods and gifts, Christmas letters. One advertisement from the time described the letters as neat, dainty folders of beautiful Christmas sentiments and mottos. This snow globe spirit is alive in Hallmark to this day. By the late 1940s, the company was sponsoring a Reader's Digest radio show on the CBS network, but it soon went into the entertainment business on its own. Its radio show, Hallmark Playhouse, morphed into Hallmark Hall of Fame, a series of television specials that began in 1951. In the early days, the Hallmark specials aired several times a year, and there was always one in December, Christmas card season. Producing everything from George C. Scott doing Arthur Miller to Cicely Tyson in the Marva Collins story, the still active Hallmark Hall of Fame, with 78 Emmy nominations, is one of the most awarded series in television history. 2009, 8 years after taking full ownership of a religious network called Odyssey, the rechristened Hallmark Channel got serious about leaning into Christmas. And Valentine's Day. 2015, the network announced 5 films ensconced in conventional Valentine visuals, traditions, and melodrama. Fast forward to Loveuary, 2024, and the network is curating ever more high-concept Valentine's Day programming. It's airing 5 films, 4 of which gave Jane Austen's themes Hallmark Quirks, featuring the network favorites Alice and Sweeney, Days of Our Lives, Biggest Loser, Will Kemp, Girlfriends, Guide to Divorce, and Mallory Jansen, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Love You, where he closes on February 24th with a Bridgerton-esque adaptation of Sense and Sensibility, starring the Hallmark neophyte Deborah Eowyndi. Them. She was in Them and True Detective. There will be Empire Waste Gowns, a literary scholar in need of a new attitude, and in An American in Austin, a woman exported to the times of Pride and Prejudice, stubbornness, love, truths, universally acknowledged, totally on brand. Brands respond to holes in the marketplace, though, and to the zeitgeist. What the world craves now is love, sweet love. Part of it is the current nostalgia for all things 1990s related, from classic hip-hop culture to beloved romantic films like Groundhog Day, As Good As It Gets, Sliding Doors, The Wedding Singer, Notting Hill, and The Best Man. Then came the Marvel Cinematic Universe, economic recession, a presidential election that bent a nation, learning how to date and love during the pandemic. In this moment of interpersonal isolation, amid all kinds of division, between the rich and the poor, between men and women, red states and blue, the meet cute, that old rom-com staple, is more appealing than ever. And Loveuary has one after another lined up. Loveuary, cushiony, bingeable, and mesmerizing, is a space of fantasy, like a land in one of Disney's parks. Life there is spotless and sugary and relentlessly fun. Cookies are warm and nostalgia reigns. We're running in the glow of our screens away from shows that lionize serial killers, away from procedurals that cold open with yet another young woman being garroted from behind, away from specious news channel chirons, away from the complexities of our own relationships and the problems that can't be fixed with a bouquet of roses. Disdain for Loveuary and Hallmark programming in general is tinged with nervousness. It's edged in a fear of how deeply time-worn tropes appeal to realists, idealists, and cynics. We're all afraid. We're all tired. So we are susceptible to living vicariously through yet another couple sealing their love at a Valentine's Day ball. Will we suffocate in this cozy second-hand joy? Will we do the work of loving one another? Of being our own cavalry? Because if not, that's a horror show right there. Those are the real Walking Dead numbers. The author of the article, Danielle Smith, is a contributing writer for the magazine and the Los Angeles-based author of Shine Bright, a very personal history of black women in pop, chosen by Pitchfork as the best music book of 2022. Smith is also host of Black Girl Songbook, a podcast focused on the stories of black women in music. And I'll read a letter of recommendation. What your laundry says about your life, what you've gone through and how you wear it, one wash cycle at a time. There's a picture under the headline, and it looks like it's at in a home with a washer, and spilling out of the washer are all these clothes, looks like sweaters and a dress, and spilling out onto the floor. Story by Lucy Corin. My father has placed me in the basket and layered laundry neatly on top of me, then topped everything with a crocheted blanket. Timestamp. Epitome of the 70s. I'm 5. He has employed a classic parental trick, his version called Rock, inspired by Frank Zappa's Help, I'm a Rock, which I also recommend. The game was pretend you're a rock You're quiet. You're still. I remember the weight of the laundry, the solemnity of my task, and the laughter just beneath it. Something about the princess and the pea being the pea. Your laundry, your life. How do you get it done? If you never think about laundry because you pay someone else to, there's a life in that. If you hardly ever get to do it because it's the least of your problems, that's a life. Laundry torments me, my mother used to say. It was almost always a mountain on the dining table back when she had children in the house, and on up through her death, just before the pandemic, from a rare disease, amyloidosis, which was described to me as not cancer, but cancer-like. I remember her walking around the house with folded stacks pressed between her hands, an outrageous cartoon tower of a sandwich. In our family, we all did housework, but she did the most, and she took it to heart. One time my grandmother came to visit and ran her finger across the top of the refrigerator and then looked at it, and then I looked at my mother for a long time. My first on-the-books job was in the Timestamp Mall. The way I remember it starts with my boss teaching me to fold pizza boxes at his restaurant. He was an intimator. He had a song for the rhythm of folding, spun the box around and smacked it. He said he'd met Robert De Niro, and Robert De Niro was going to launch his acting career. Then he switched me to his other store. That store sold clothes. It was the best store in the mall, not a store for girls like me. Girls I was afraid I wanted to be to shop there. You fold there too. Said I didn't have anything to wear. Well, he was the boss. I met him an hour before the store opened, and he picked out clothes from the shop for me to wear. His clothes. Sell this many of these sweaters, and I'll buy you a six-pack of whatever beer you want. And it went on from there. Getting to keep one of the sweaters? Can I even wash this? Then, series of apartments, navigating shared washers and dryers. In one, hauling my basket up and down winding staircases to the basement of a divided Victorian where H.P. Lovecraft once lived. My puppy, following, then galloping ahead, disappeared. We called and called to each other, seeming to pass on staircases separated by walls. Tormenting laundry. I found her eventually, crouched near the machines. In another, I loathed the trip through snow to the laundromat so much that I did everything in the tub and lived with my clothes hanging around me all winter, dripping as I smoked out the window. The whole universe of laundry relationships began in those apartments, too. How to contend with another person's pants in a puddle on the floor. The refusal of or insistence on sorting. How everyone feels about scent. I was raised without television, and when I finally allowed myself to own one, I made a rule that I had to do something productive while I watched. Suddenly, all I wanted was a lot of laundry to fold. I even mended. When I bought my first house, I thought I would never have to pay rent again. That didn't turn out to be the case, but I have managed since then always to have my own laundry machines. That marked a great divide, a shift in my understanding of myself as autonomous rather than a sheet in the wind. A quarter became just a quarter, not something to hoard. Also, around then I was watching The Sopranos, folding my laundry, and there was my old boss as a henchman. Then, there he was, shot, gasping his last breath in a silly shirt. I brought this up not long ago, laundry, and how you can tell your life through it, with a mentor my mother's age who has in many ways mothered me. You couldn't shut us up about laundry. This woman is facing a cancer that will kill her, but not yet, we say, not yet. On her woozy way home from an early treatment, she went to, timestamp, practically bankrupt Sears, thinking, what I'm going to need for this is really a good washer and dryer. She bought herself the top of the line, delivered and installed in the laundry room that occupies the center of her little house. They're just so big. I have done laundry with those machines, great for blankets, but if you want to wash a shirt, or God forbid, socks, you're going to have to tip yourself upside down headfirst into the drum to fetch them. These machines, all I can think of is the end of the fall of the House of Usher and its imitators, the house spinning with the pain and chaos of the world pulled down into the earth, and I loved her so much. I know, front loader could solve this particular problem. I've done well. I even have some things to say about dry cleaning. Since the pandemic, I have regular Zoom meetings for work, timestamp. I like to set things up so that I'm ready for a long meeting with a nice pile of laundry. There I am, looking at a screen, doing something else that feels constant, humble, harmlessly deceitful, ultimately useful. These are my own necessary and chosen adornments in my hands and the shapes of the people I love. Lucy Corin's fourth book of fiction is the novel The Swank Hotel. She was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2023. I'm going to read another talk section. This is an interview with John Malkovich. John Malkovich on really, really being John Malkovich. Interviewed by David Marchese. And Marchese writes, there's a scene in that modern classic of screwball existentialism, Being John Malkovich, from 1999, in which John Malkovich, playing a version of himself, enters a portal that others have been using to climb inside his mind. Suddenly, Malkovich is in a world populated solely by variations on himself. Malkovich is a flirtatious sexpot, a genteel waiter, a jazz chanteuse, a bemused child, everyone speaking only the word Malkovich. In a way, that scene is a microcosm of the actor's decades-long, always interesting career. He's played a million different parts, but somehow they're all defined by the unmistakable, enigmatic, magnetic presence of Malkovich. Same goes for his work in the Apple TV series The New Look, premiering February 14th, which is based on the experiences of the fashion icons Christian Dior, Coco Chanel, Cristobal Balenciaga, and others who helped build the French fashion industry while enduring the impossible complexities of World War II. Malkovich, playing the courtier and Dior mentor Lucien Leong, delivers a softer, warmer performance than the ones for which he is probably best known. But even so, with his off-kilter line reading, his louche manner, his oddly wavering yet commanding voice, and his general air of playing a game to which only he knows the rules, the role is, as always, pure Malkovich. David asks, if we take style to mean a manner of doing something, could you articulate the John Malkovich style? Not really, because it's not something I think about much. What I am or what I do, but I've always felt style is the only constant in my life. By style, I mean simply the way you move through life. If you get sad news, how do you respond? What do you do if you're angry, if you're amused, if you're moved? That's what style is. It's not really up to me to say what mine is. Do you think of style as something that people cultivate or as innate? That's a great question. If you've lived long enough, which I classify under if you're lucky, you experience things. So it's cultivated based on your native curiosity, on the experiences you've been granted or blessed with or suffered through. David says, this is a digression, but I love the Sandro Miller book that you did. It's a collection of photos of you imitating famous portraits. The thing that I find mesmerizing is the way that you seem to inhabit the same psychological state as the people in the photos. What is the magic that allows you to look at a photo and not just mimic the positioning or the facial musculature, but the internal state. Well, in a very good photo, everything is evident. Say the Marilyn Monroe one. A lot of the people have something haunted about them. Then some of my favorites are super childish, and I never grew up. When I play with our granddaughter, we're pretty much equal in outlook. The book has a long interview, this is David, with you where you say, I'm capable of belief, at least inside the theater, outside of the theater, not so much. Why? Because that's what my life has taught me. It took me 7 years of analysis to learn that when people say something, it isn't necessarily what they meant. I'm not very clever. I remember once meeting the head of a country, I won't say which one, at a dinner one night after a performance in a faraway land. He kept telling me about how uncorrupt the country was because he was running it. I think he's still in prison. That's what I mean, theater. It's a perfect world. Life is more like making a movie push a boulder up a hill every day and hope it doesn't flatten you. So I've always felt most at home in the theater. At home with myself, my emotions, my colleagues, their emotions, with how we express them. That's harder to find in life. David says, aside from your work, what do you believe in? I believe in people, generally. I believe in humanity, somewhat. I have a great mistrust of ideology, maybe even more than I do religion. I'm not a believer, but I don't make some big show of it. I'm wary of all the things that people believe that make them think they're them. Explain that. People who say my ideology is this. Yeah, but that changes. It's based on feelings and what you know and what you don't. I think people are more interesting than that. I've directed Terry Johnson's play Hysteria 3 times. It's about the meeting of Freud and Dali. And in my opinion, Freud was right in that the study of us is enough. Let's don't complicate more than we need to. That's what a lot of our beliefs do, in my opinion, which of course can be wrong. You first became known for your Steppenwolf Theater Company. Work, emotionally confrontational, pushing audiences or forcing them to react. I'm curious how you think contemporary audiences are different from audiences back then. Hey, each generation is entitled to do their own thing. There's things my kids like that I don't quite grasp, but that's the natural flow of life. We say these young people are lost in this way or that. I could also say, what were we, geniuses? I don't think so. Things seem crazy sometimes and unrecognizable, but I'm 70 years old. It's perfectly natural that they seem unrecognizable because part of the thing of aging is, as Linda Lohman said in Death of a Salesman, life is a casting off. This is the natural ebb and flow. People change, art changes, their relationship to art changes, the artists change. Did you notice, after being John Malkovich, if people's reaction to you changed? That movie is not about you, but that film reified an idea about you. That's an interesting question. That kind of happened, but mostly with journalists because it's easy. It's a bit lazy, but we're all lazy, so that's no big sin. I think being John Malkovich introduced 2 uniquely talented young filmmakers, Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze. When I first saw it, I told Spike what I thought, and he told me he thought I was too close to it. That made me laugh. In the end, it didn't really change my life. It was an unsettling thought that that's what I would be forever after, but I don't think it happened. Was it your idea to cast Charlie Sheen? Yes, it was originally written for Kevin Bacon, who I had worked with and found very entertaining. But then Kevin didn't do it, and Spike asked me, what did I think about so-and-so? But I got stuck on the idea of Charlie Sheen. He's hilarious, very gifted actor, and I think was going through a rough patch at the time. And David says, for about 20 years. It was more than a week, let's say, but at the Venice Film Festival, when the audience understood that Charlie was my best friend, there was a rolling laughter that lasted 10 minutes. It destroyed any lingering existential malaise. The line, when I'm talking about being harassed by this coven of lesbian witches, and he says, "Listen, man, give me your number when you're through with them." That's a tough line for anybody but Charlie. Aside from Charlie Sheen's work, this is David, what might you turn to when you're trying to combat existential malaise? I'm not very existential because I'm not profound. So many people think a lot about this or that. I don't think about this or that. I just do this or that. David, you've now made reference a couple times to your own lack of profundity or insight. There's evidence out there that there's something going on behind the eyes of John Malkovich. Hard to say what it is, though. Hard to say. That's my problem. And David says, I saw Matt Damon share an anecdote in which he talked about acting with you on Rounders. You came to the set. I'm debating right now whether to torture you with my impression of Teddy KGB. Have at it, he says. He said you sat down and did, I can't believe I'm doing this if you don't have my money. You did the scene, everyone on set cheered, and you then leaned forward and under your breath said, I'm a terrible actor. Are you? That was really a reflection on choice, meaning that this was a kind of huge performance that I can do for better or worse. It's a performance, got a lot of attention, it's very excessive. But I've seen bigger behavior than that in restaurants in St. Petersburg or Moscow. So am I a terrible actor? I think I can be fine, depending on material. But also, what is the take on it? Because that has to be a decision of the director. If John Dahl, who's a rather subtle person, would have said, listen, can you take 100 miles an hour off that or do it again? I would have said, of course. You've done a lot of disparate work, and that there's always some Malkovich-ness that comes through. You're not one of those actors who people talk about as subsuming themselves into the character. And John writes, there is a kind of technical actor who does often fantastic and pretty purely technical things. I'm not really that. I'm not sure how much of it fascinates me. Often that just draws attention to itself. I can appreciate it, especially when somebody's very good at it, but I don't think there are 50 characters like that in an actor. There are like five. For me, I think more about their worldview. How do you view the world? The world has a people of Walmart factor. I'm one of them. The world has so many things in it that are fascinating and strange, but it can be quite beautiful. David says, you left me hanging on something. Do you remember what it was about being John Malkovich that made Spike Jonze say you were too close to it? I do. That was after I'd seen the cut of the film that was going to be shown to the people from Cannes. Although this best note in that vein was when he told me some choice I had made, he told me that wasn't the way John Malkovich would do it, which I thought was fantastic. But what was your reaction to the screening? I didn't like it. What I said to Spike is I thought he had made a Bergman film out of it, and it was really a Bergman film conceptually. So what it needed was to go back to kind of Jewish vaudeville. I found it very long and not funny. The cut I saw was almost 20 minutes longer than what was released. I have great faith in Spike and his talent, and I knew he'd shot fantastic things. It was not punchy enough for the way it was written. That was my opinion. And then when I saw it again, that's the film that was released, it was very good. A lot of times directors can want to put everything in, but there's a film one conceives, there's a film one writes, and then there's the film one shoots. But none of those things actually exist. There's only the film you edit. That's the only thing that actually exists. And a lot of times people want them all to exist together, and they can't. Editing does what it wants, and the more you fight it, the more trouble you'll have. You brought up your grandmother, you brought up your granddaughter earlier, and I know your grandfather, Steve, was an influential figure for you. I was very close to him. For whatever reason, I was with my grandfather all the time. He owned the newspaper. He had worked there. When he actually worked, which was not something he was fantastically fond of, and his older brother, Carl, a lawyer, had founded the newspaper, but he was murdered. Your grandfather's brother was murdered? His older brother. Did that loom over the family? No. He was an attorney, and as I remember it, there was a person who was called Dr. Gore, and his son, I believed, had been accused of murdering the doctor's second wife. Carl had started the newspaper, and Dr. Gore had told him he would kill him if he defended the son in his this trial, which he chose to do. And Dr. Gore shot him in the back in the alley of the newspaper office. That's all I remember about it. So that's how my grandfather got the newspaper. He was an amputee and then a double amputee. So my grandmother did all the work and published the paper while he talked to people at various cafes and bet on horses. Are you like Steve? In some ways, there was something like a child about him. Possessing childlike qualities is something that you've brought up multiple times. You're obviously a thinker with a philosophical cast of mind, even if you don't want to admit it. So what do you mean when you say you think of yourself as having childlike qualities? We have our granddaughter. It's very easy for me to engage on that level. We walk around the neighborhood, and she shows me where all the dogs live in the various houses, and she kind of turns around and goes, woof, woof, and which is my signal to bark. For me, it's nothing. To be an actor, part of you has to remain as a child. I think it's even as simple as I remember how my grandfather was with me, and that's kind of how I was with our children and how I am with our grandchild. Everything was kind of for fun and not particularly real. That makes me think of your being able to find belief in the theater more easily than outside. John writes, so many things in life are kind of unsolvable and therefore at certain points incredibly tiresome. People feel that and then absolutely know the opposite is true. As they say in New Jersey, go ahead, I don't know. I want to go back to the line that you quoted from Death of a Salesman. Life is a casting off. You're 70 now. What are you casting off? You have to let go of the past, of connections. At this age, there are people who are dead now that were very close to me. There are people I love to have conversations with, who I sometimes dream of, and have the conversation in dreams that I'll never see again. That's a natural part of life. You have to let it go. It's cast off in the sense that it's allowed to float away. It's also not weighing you down. It's gone. And what are you holding on to? Family, work, friends. Not as many as I used to, because some people close to me didn't choose to maintain that relationship. And sometimes I didn't choose to, which of course is everyone's choice. I just, as Joan Didion said, play it as it lays. And I'll end with a letter to Judge John Hodgman. Are cucumbers a fruit? Judge John Hodgman makes a final ruling. The encyclopedia says one thing. A husband who wrote in has his own feelings about the definition. Sam writes, my wife, Katie, insists the definition of a fruit should follow the encyclopedia, the fleshy or dry ripened ovary of a flowering plant. This includes tomato, eggplant, cucumber, and many other things I call vegetables. She's getting her PhD in genetics, in part studying tomatoes. I think it should be something like a sweet, juicy, edible plant. And the judge writes, well, you've both earned a master's in pointless argumentation from me. In real life, you would never say, remember to buy the fruits named by some as cucumbers on your way home. Unless you're both weird AI. And honestly, who knows these days? You would just say, get chooks. So I presume this is just a thought experiment you use to annoy each other. But while you're both guilty of pedantry, I don't want to erase your wife's actual expertise in this field. So in this case, I side with Dr. Tomato. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.